Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we hear an incredible story about a mathematical genius behind the company that makes the internet work. Back in the early 1990s, the web was a hurry-up-and-wait endeavor, slow to load images, and any amount of traffic could crash a website. But an Israeli-American mathematician named Danny Lewin developed mathematical algorithms that allowed speed to flourish on the internet. In essence, those algorithms were like traffic cops, directing information between source and user through the quickest route possible. His company, Akamai, today helps power many of the highest volume websites around the world. Whether you download a song or video on iTunes, stream a movie on Netflix, or update your Facebook page, Akamai makes it happen. Well, that's an interesting story, but the story is much better than that. Danny Lewin died on September 11th on American Airlines Flight 11, and according to since-published accounts from flight attendants to ground control, was probably the first casualty as he was resisting the terrorist. Probably because he'd been an Israeli counterterrorism soldier prior to his days in America. An even more incredible irony was that on a day when phones failed due to overwhelming volume, it was Danny's company that provided the technology to keep the web running. Sites like ABC, CNN, MSNBC, New York Post, and Washington Post were crashing under the volume. It was his company that propped all of those websites up to keep us informed on that horrible day. My guest today has written a remarkable book about this remarkable, relatively unknown man. No Better Time, The Brief Remarkable Life of Danny Lewin, the Genius Who Transformed the Internet. Molly Knight Raskin is my guest. She's a freelance journalist who's worked for PBS and the Baltimore Sun, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Molly Knight Raskin, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
How did you come upon the story of Danny Lewin?
Well, you know, really, I came upon the story because I just heard little bits and pieces of his life story from a friend. And the more I heard about him, it was prior to the anniversary of September 11th, 2001, and the 10th anniversary of that day. And I heard these little bits and pieces of his life, and I kept thinking, we can't be talking about the same person here. And if so, and he accomplished all these things, why don't I know about him, and why don't more people know about him? And so I started to research his life a little bit and speak to some people who knew him, and suddenly this story emerged that to me was so extraordinary that I felt really like I had to tell it. I had to write the book, and it was really the first time that something like that's ever happened to me as a journalist, where I've said, I got to drop everything and write this story now.
So who was the first person that, where you're hearing the story about him, that said, oh, wow, I have to write this story? Was it his professor at MIT, or...?
It was actually his best friend, a guy named Marco Greenberg, who lives in New York City, who was met Danny when he was a teenager living in Israel. He was born and raised in America, but moved to Israel as a teenager with his family. And Marco met him there working out at a local gym, and they became fast friends. And Marco really knew him better than almost anybody, and just happened in conversation, again, through some mutual friend in New York, to be talking about his friend and his life and how he'd always kind of wished that somebody had told the story. And the more he talked about this friend of his, the more I said, well, why hasn't anybody told the story? And then it became, well, I'd like to be the one to tell the story. And that's how it kind of evolved.
And for those who don't know, Danny Lewin was a mathematician who helped revolutionize the internet. He transformed it. He made things like Netflix possible. It's his algorithms that basically allow the internet to hold such huge volumes of traffic as it does today. And I guess he began developing these algorithms at MIT. Did he have an end idea in mind, or was it just pure math?
Well, you know, at the time, he had a big idea in mind. So, you know, the internet at that time, this was the mid to late 90s, and the internet was painfully slow back then. I mean, you know, now we're used to this sort of instant gratification where we click on, we get to the website, and that's that. And back then, you know, you had this sort of interminable wait, and then the website would say, try again later. And it was frustrating, and it was a huge impediment to the growth of the internet. And a lot of people at MIT, where Danny was studying at the time, were kind of working on it in different ways. But most people weren't really thinking about math. As you mentioned, Danny was a mathematician, a theoretical mathematician, and most people weren't really thinking about math as a way to solve this problem. You know, they were kind of building out the hardware of their servers and trying some other solutions, and Danny came along with this idea. And yes, I think at the time, you know, he thought this could be a solution. But I think when he came up with the set of algorithms that made up his master's thesis, he wasn't really thinking necessarily that this was going to become one of the biggest companies to revolutionize the Internet of that time.
Now, what's interesting is his backstory. You mentioned he grew up in Israel, and of course, growing up in Israel, you have to do a stint in the Israeli Defense Forces. He was actually in a counterterrorism unit?
Yes, and that was really one of the early pieces of Danny's story that I found to be just so remarkable, was that this wasn't a sort of geeky scientist or mathematician like you might expect, you know, the stereotype holds. Instead, he was incredibly gifted physically as well, and so he moved to Israel as a teenager, not wanting to go, and really didn't have any family or friends there, and just his parents and brothers, they moved, and it was lonely and it was tough, but he really fell in love with the country, and I think it was just the intensity of his personality sort of met its match in Israel. And so by the time he turned 18, you know, he's at an Israeli high school, and most of his friends were getting ready to serve the country, and he didn't have to because he wasn't native born, but he decided early on that he wanted to. He wanted to prove himself and, you know, and show everybody that he could do it. And not only did he serve, but he served in and was selected for one of the most elite counterterrorism units in the world, which is the Israeli unit called Sayeret Matkal, really high-level counterterrorism and intelligence operations. And that was pretty much unheard of at the time. I mean, most people didn't believe that he was in this unit at all.
Were you able to find out much about his service, or is that pretty much secret or classified?
Well, it's one of the trademarks of this unit is that the missions are of such high-level intelligence that they are secret. And part of your training when you get to this unit is to learn basically never to say a word. So I was never able to find out any specifics about the time he was there. Of course, it was a short period of time, 3 years before he left to pursue graduate school. But I do know that during the time he was in that unit, that small unit, they carried out some pretty spectacular counterterrorism operations in various parts of the world. So it was no doubt an interesting time of his life.
Now, eventually he came to MIT to study math, and he came into the orbit of a man who began as his mentor and eventually his business partner, Tom Leighton, who was a professor at MIT. Talk about their relationship.
Well, their relationship was something that really interested me when I decided to write the book, because Danny came to MIT again as a graduate student, and you know, he'd gotten into all the top grad schools for computer science and math. He was really so brilliant, but he went to MIT and chose MIT largely because of this one professor, this gentleman named Tom Leighton. And Tom was really one of the preeminent scholars in his field. It was this very rarefied field of math and computer science, theoretical math. And he was 15 years older than Danny, a tenured professor already at MIT. And Danny arrived at the school just so eager to impress him. You know, just really wanting to, you know, make a statement and eventually work with him. A lot of students were like that. Tom was kind of a star there. And it wasn't long before Professor Leighton realized that Danny was actually really brilliant and that they spoke the same language and they were interested in the same problems. And so what started as this professor-student relationship turned very quickly into a friendship and then into a business partnership eventually. But they were a funny pair. I mean, I loved writing about them because Danny was this young, bulky, athletic student from Israel, and Tom was this tall, lean, sort of circumspect, quiet professor at MIT. And then they became just inseparable. Once they started the company together, that they eventually found that they were together 24/7 sometimes, and so they could almost finish each other's sentences. So it was a really beautiful friendship and one of a lot of respect and trust and admiration.
You know, they say that mathematics is a young man's game. It's like, you know, the advances you make happen pretty early in your 20s. And mm-hmm. It's interesting that instead of becoming a teacher-student, they really became collaborators in many ways.
They were definitely collaborators. And I think, you know, you can't help but wonder, you know, how different Tom Leighton's life would have been and vice versa, you know, if he hadn't met Danny. But yeah, Tom was really happy where he was. Again, he was a tenured professor at MIT. And that, for him, was kind of the pinnacle. I mean, it was a great life. And then sort of in blew this student who, in many ways, sort of took his breath away with his energy and enthusiasm and excitement and belief that these ideas could actually be used outside the ivory tower of academia and transform the world somehow. And so their friendship was really unusual. And, you know, I think that sort of a lot of people who met Danny Lewin say their lives would have been so different if they hadn't met him and then gone along for this wild ride that was his life.
as we soon learn, things changed after he went out into the world. But let's talk about his discoveries, these algorithms. You know, I know sort of what an algorithm is, but I really don't know how they apply in the practical world. What was special about his work that translated to the company Akamai that, of course, transformed the Internet?
Well, so I started this book maybe like a little bit like yourself. I really only had a vague idea of what algorithms were. I was actually a little bit scared of the word. You know, to me, it implies sort of high-level math and science. And so, you know, I wrote the book for people like myself, for lay people who with no background in computer science or math. And what I learned very early on is just that an algorithm is basically a set of instructions. So we use them every day to bake a cake or to follow, you know, get from point A to point B in our car. And the algorithms that Danny wrote, though, of course, were incredibly complex. And the math was not something that a lot of people understood at the time. And still today, very few people understand it. You have to have a certain mind and a certain level of understanding to actually grasp what it was he was doing. But the basic idea was to use these algorithms or sets of directions to reroute traffic around the Internet. The Internet is like this wild, and still is today, we call it the Wild West, but kind of this massive, crazy middle land out there between points of communication that is hard to get through. And sometimes there were traffic jams. And oftentimes when it was a really popular website, all the data would get blocked up and the website would crash. And this was just a problem that was absolutely universal at the time. And so Danny thought, well, if I could use these algorithms that I use for mathematics and reroute, find a way to program these software with their own intelligent software to reroute the traffic around the jams and sort of create our own magic layer on the Internet, then I'm on to something really big. And so that's essentially what he did. He used very high-level math to program these servers with this set of instructions that would circumvent the traffic jams, and the information would travel much faster. And this was a real hot commodity at a time when everybody was building businesses on the web that depended on speed and efficiency.
Of course, this was the 1990s when we had the dot-com boom. Levin was cashing in. He wanted to turn these ideas into concrete ideas, and so did he join Akamai?
Well, Akamai actually came about because after Danny wrote this set of algorithms and showed it to Tom Leighton, and then suddenly showed it to a couple of friends in the business school at MIT, and people were saying, hey, this isn't just a master's thesis. This isn't something on paper. This is real. You could actually use this to transform the Internet. And, you know, Danny was really, you know, a confident guy when it came to his own math and ideas. And so he started to say, okay, maybe they have a point here. And at the time, he was a really struggling graduate student. He had two young kids crammed into a little dormitory at MIT. And so he thought, okay, well, let's try and make a business plan out of this. And once that got started and they got the support of some people who really understood business and who understood they were onto something really big, they built sort of a team around them of experienced businessmen, he and Tom Leighton did, and they created the company. And so that company was created in 1998, and they called it Akamai Technologies. It's a Hawaiian word for clever, smart. You know, there was a time of eBay and Amazon and all these cool names, so you had to have something original, right? So that was the company that he created, and they took that company public in October of 1999, and it was an absolute breakout Hollywood-style story of massive wealth created overnight.
And Akamai remains a major company today, although I think it's sort of under the radar because unless you're involved in communications technology, it's sort of like the glue that keeps everything running. I mean, it's one of these companies that sort of help other companies run their websites and handle massive volumes. So it's become a huge company. Although at the time of 2000, the dot-com bust, it would look like it wasn't going to be a going concern.
Yeah, definitely.
But there were a couple events that actually sort of helped seal the rise of the company, and one of them had to do with major news events of the late 1990s, which, mm-hmm. if you remember, involved President Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. How did that have an effect on their business?
Well, it was actually, you know, the scandal proved very fortuitous for their own business model because at the time, you know, part of the sort of selling point of this technology was, you know, what Danny called, like, there would be a time where there'd be some cataclysmic news event and everybody would be getting online to find out information. Today, that's just, we all do that. But at the time, that was pretty new idea. You know, we got our newspapers then, but we weren't
going television, online. Yes, exactly.
Television and radio. But we weren't going to the Internet much for news. And Danny kept saying, you know, besides business, another area where this technology is going to be really useful is when there's a huge news event and these media companies have to handle all of this traffic. And, of course, that came along with the affair between Monica Lewinsky and President Clinton. And, you know, it was really the first time that, well, first of all, Congress, you know, said, okay, we're going to release all the information, all the details, scintillating details of this scandal. And then everybody was clamoring to get them. And they did it online. They decided to try and use the Internet. And so, you know, people were running around with floppy disks loading all of this onto the Internet. But then the problem became that everybody wanted to read it, and they couldn't get online. The websites that were hosting this data were crashing right and left. And that's when people started to really say, okay, this is a problem. This is actually a really big problem, and somebody's got to find an answer. And so it was really then that I think more eyes started turning towards Danny and Tom and their business partners in this technology.
And Akamai was there with pretty much a ready answer at that point.
Absolutely. They were there with a ready answer and one that worked. And the cool thing about the technology that they pioneered was that, you know, the more information you loaded into it, the more data, the better it worked. So it was just this truly, you know, extraordinary kind of, they like to refer to it as like a magic layer of the Internet. You couldn't see it, but it was doing incredible things behind the curtains.
My guest today is Molly Knight Raskin. She is a freelance journalist, worked in television as well as print. Her new book is titled No Better Time, The Brief Remarkable Life of Danny Lewin, the genius who transformed the Internet. And it's a really interesting book. It's interesting for what he actually accomplished in his life, but of course, there's this incredible irony at the end of his life, which ended on 9/11. And it was on one of the American flights from Boston, one of the first to hit the World Trade Center. And leading up to that point, Akamai was in really serious problem. It was not doing well in the dot-com bust. In fact, he was headed to Los Angeles on that day to, I guess, shore up some funding. Is that right for the company? Or
yes, he did. I mean, it was a couple of important meetings he had, but yeah, it was really at the time the company was struggling to survive the dot-com crash.
And the interesting thing is now, as a lot of the documents from 9/11 have become public, it's probable that he was the first victim of 9/11. The thinking is that when Muhammad Atta seized his plane, that he fought back and tried to fight off the hijackers.
That's right. You know, I set out to write a book about the way that Danny Lewin lived, which was so extraordinary to me. But sort of all along, and certainly during the process of writing it, there was this piece of the story that was so tragic and, like you said, just so ironic that it seemed that, you know, couldn't be true. Danny did board a flight that morning, American Airlines Flight 11, to go to California for business. It was a routine flight for him. He had taken that flight probably 30 times that year. So he knew the flight attendants by name. It was a really busy time, struggling to keep the company afloat. He hadn't slept all night. They were planning layoffs, very stressful time. But shortly after the flight took off, this hijacking began. And Flight 11 was the first one to crash that morning, so nobody knew anything at this point in time. But, you know, while we don't know exactly what happened on that flight, and we never will, I do point out in the book that Danny did, we know from the facts gathered by the 9/11 Commission, engage in some kind of a struggle with one of the terrorists before the plane crashed, before it was hijacked. The passenger in 9B, the flight attendants told ground control, and that was Danny's seat, did rise from his seat and try and engage with a terrorist and was killed from behind by a terrorist wielding a knife. And it was just an incredibly tragic irony in the fact, you know, that I really struggled with this while writing the book, but to think about the fact that he was sitting on that flight and he knew counterterrorism, he was trained in it, and he knew rudimentary Arabic, so he probably knew what some of these guys were saying before anything even happened on that flight. He must have known something was wrong. So we don't know exactly what happened, but I think I build a pretty good case for, in the book, the fact that he was not only the first victim, but that he also did try and fight back.
And the bigger irony is what happened to his company in the wake of that horrible, terrible outcome of his plane. the internet absolutely exploded on 9/11.
Yes.
And his company basically was the thing that held the information infrastructure together. You write that the people at Akamai knew very quickly that Danny was on that plane, and yet ABC, you know, all the major networks, CNN, every major network basically were calling frantically saying, we need your help. And ironically, it perhaps maybe saved their company.
That's right. You know, I think that was really one of the worst days of a lot of people's lives who knew him. You know, very quickly they knew that he was on the flight. So immediately after the flight crashed, you know, a couple people had spoken to him, even in the hours following the flight early that morning, and known that he was on the plane. He was headed for Los Angeles. And there just was a moment that was, like, really extraordinary, where they had to really say, okay, we have two choices here. We've lost our heart and soul. We're devastated. We're grieving. We're in shock. We can pack it up and go home and say, you know what, this is just too much. Or we can just power on. What would Danny do? And it was just like everybody went not only into autopilot, but they worked for days to keep websites like CNN. And CNN, Danny had been down in Atlanta and personally pitched the head of the interactive CNN website and said, you know, one day you guys are going to really need our technology. And that day they were scrambling. They were calling Akamai and saying, we really need your help. People are desperate to find out what's going on, and our website is crashing. In fact, CNN did go down that morning for about half an hour, I believe. And so they called Akamai, and Akamai quickly got the site back up and running again. And it wasn't just news. It was the Red Cross website, American Airlines website, to talk about the path so people could find out who had been killed on that flight that day. And the irony of that was just too much, I think. It was shocking for everybody who worked there, and just a truly devastating loss.
Yeah. But it sounds like his work still lives on at Akamai, even though he's been dead now for over 10 years. He really created software packages for these large companies that really has made all the advances in the internet, from streaming video to all sorts of packages, available.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, you know, there is, to me, there's a beautiful end of the story, which is that, you know, the company soldiered on. It soldiered through 9/11, but then also through, I mean, as you remember, the economy got even worse after that. And they just, you know, pressed on, created a new kind of business model targeting bigger, more established companies that weren't going to disappear in any more dot-com busts. And they really did so in his spirit, but the really wonderful thing is that the technology that he created survived. And today, you know, some of the algorithms that Akamai still uses to keep these massive websites running are not that different. I mean, Danny would recognize them as his, as his own. They've changed, they've grown, they've gotten a little better over time, but they're, in essence, they're still his work. And so today, really, you know, it's funny. It's just kind of his spirit still definitely lives inside the company, and I think they look for people to hire to work with who remind them of him, just really determined, incredibly energetic, you know, big personalities. And then, of course, Tom Leighton, his professor at MIT, is now the chairman of the company, which today controls about 30% of the world's internet traffic. It's a huge multi-billion-dollar company now, and I know they all think, you know, Danny would be so proud to see that. And then he would probably yell at them and say they weren't doing quite enough and they had to do better.
Well, I was going to say, is his legacy live on in the company? I mean, how important is that legacy to how Akamai works today?
It's incredibly important. I mean, you know, the fact is, yes, it's been over a decade. So those who knew him personally and built the company with him, those folks are dwindling. You know, people move on. But there are sort of a handful of people at the company who have stayed, and I think many of them would say that they've done so because of him. They just don't want to let go of this incredible thing they built and kept building in his memory. And so when you walk through the halls of the company today, you know, you definitely hear his name. His name comes up a lot. They have an annual award at the company for young new employees and sort of who work in his spirit and contribute a lot. They do a lot of public service in his name. Of course, there's a small square outside the office in Cambridge, Mass, with his name on it and a small tree planted in his memory. And his family is still very active in remembering him as well and contributing to various charities and, marking the anniversary every year of his loss. So, and in Israel, he's considered a hero as well, which is really interesting to go over there and hear people discuss his impact and, legacy as a soldier, which was sort of the other big part of the story. So I do think that, today there's still this spirit there of kind of, let's do it better than everybody else, and let's do it right now. You know, that sort of goes to the title of the book. There's no better time. Just do it now. And Danny was always like that. He never wasted 1 minute, 1 second, 1 hour of the day. He just moved so fast.
You know, it's really interesting when we think of, the great and transformative inventions. You know, we think of Edison and we think of these people's names. Now, when we have so much technology, we really don't think of a single name. And certainly, I'm sure Danny had lots of help in the course of creating these ideas. But it sounds like, other than the people at the company and a few people, people really do not know the effect his work has had on contemporary life.
No, that's true. I mean, people ask me that sometimes. They say, wouldn't he be a household name today? I mean, look, this company is so huge. And, I mean, I do think so. I think his personality was so big and so bold that eventually he would do something that would make him more of a household name. But, if you think about it, we associate those big names in technology, like, if you will, Bill Gates or Steve Jobs
Zuckerman,
or Jeff Bezos or Zuckerman. We know those names, though, because all of their technology and the things that they've contributed to the Internet are things that, for example, we hold in our hand every day. That's why we think of Steve Jobs all the time, or we log on to Amazon every day and order things, or we check Facebook. And so those names are always sort of in the front of our mind when it comes to technological advances. But what Akamai does, like I said, it's sort of the magic layer. It's something we don't see. And so, in effect, we do pretty much take it for granted, and we don't know much about how it's created. Or how it sustains the traffic on the web. And so, maybe people wouldn't have known his name. I don't know, because what he did was behind the scenes. It was the magic. And maybe he would have done something different or bigger. But it was big, and that's really what attracted me to the story and why I wanted to write the book, is because his story to me, whether or not you understand anything about math or science or technology or even interested in that kind of thing, is that we can all create something that outlasts us or outlives us. We have our own legacy in our own hands, and what we do with that is up to us. But this is a story that, if anything, I think makes people read it and kind of move maybe a little faster, just a little bit, or dream a little bigger,
Well, it's a really interesting book. The name of the book is No Better Time. Ollie, thanks very much for joining us.
It's been truly a pleasure, and I really appreciate the time, and thanks so much, Rich.
Freelance journalist Molly Knight Raskin speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her book is titled No Better Time, The Brief Remarkable Life of Danny Lewin, the Genius Who Transformed the Internet. It's published by DeCapo. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.